Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes Dallas what it is? Are we the city behind America's football team? Are we defined by the Kennedy assassination or the long-canceled primetime soap opera? If none of those cliches can describe us, what does bring us together? And how does our apparent lack of interest in our own past bode for our future? Those questions plagued Harvey J. Graff the entire time he lived and worked here as a professor at UTD, and they stayed with him even after he moved away. So he kept researching the city's past and trying to understand what he sees as a notable lack of identity. Harvey J. Graff is now professor of English and history at Ohio State University. His new book is called The Dallas Myth, The Making and Unmaking of an American City. Harvey, welcome to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here, and I value resuming my old experiences with KERA.
Great. We're glad to have you. Let's start with this, Harvey. Can you describe the myth of Dallas?
I think one of the most important things that I do in the book, Chris, is to argue that there is no single myth. My own historical research, to me somewhat surprisingly in its clarity, showed that there are at least two myths. And what we commonly accept as the Dallas myth in the late 20th and early 21st century really is the second of the two myths. The first one, the one I consider to be foundational, is less surprising than the one that comes to dominate Dallas's history in the 20th century. And that's the myth that Dallas was really born urban. It was a city destined to grow. Dallas, in this view, is recognized that it sits at the crossroads that may go far back to early Native peoples, maybe even prehistoric times, but certainly major east-west and north-south trade routes prior to the settlement of the city. The first couple generations of Dallas builders really think that they have the world by the tail. It's a great place. It's not with orange smog alerts, as I heard on the lead into the show. But it's a place, importantly, that is where the country is going, from east to west, from north to south. It's a market town. It's among the richest agricultural areas in the country. Dallas, we forget for good reasons, really sits on the western edge of the cotton frontier.
And in fact, it took a little doing to get the railroads to be right here in Dallas.
Well, that's another Dallas tradition, both a myth and a reality. That was one of the first big steps in which Dallas leaders were able to use public monies to further private interests and establish a lure to bring the railroad, particularly to have the railroads link with Dallas much closer to town than the railroad builders had initially thought.
So
that starts one aspect of the Dallas way that I call stealth and theft.
Let's go back to the second myth, the one that came about in the 20s and 30s, because it is sort of an odd story if you think about it, especially if you look around the city.
I guess 20 years ago I would have agreed with you that it's odd, but I'm not sure did I see it as odd anymore. Let me try to explain that. First, the second myth is the myth that there is no reason for Dallas to be, partly based on a little bit of wrong geography in the belief that cities need to be ports in order to be successful. The railroad becomes Dallas's first link to the outer world, although Dallas, since the 1870s, has been talking about and trying to build a navigable route from the Gulf. There are a couple pictures of some of the boats that tried to do this and failed in my book. The locational issue becomes one. The richness of the agricultural and market past is forgotten, and the growth of Dallas becomes the act of great white entrepreneurial men. And here it's important to stress all those characteristics, the white, the male, and the entrepreneurial. When the Dallas Citizens Council organized itself, there were only business people in it. There were no lawyers or doctors. Professionals were not considered to be the right kind of boosters. In retrospect, I think that in some ways it's hard to imagine a Dallas that made it through the 20s and 30s and the travails of those times, did not sort of reinvent itself in terms of images and languages and language that claimed that Dallas was the act of creation of a certain entrepreneurial class. It was just too easy a path. It accommodated too well with the breaking of unions, with the lessening down of the role of the Ku Klux Klan in Dallas, with the triumph in securing the Texas Centennial for a city that did not exist 100 years before that point in 1837.
Yet you write, only in Dallas would the term oligarchy in action be considered a compliment and something to strive for.
Correct.
Yeah, so I guess what that myth really did is reinforce for people that it was important to acquiesce to this small group of people who wanted to run the city, ostensibly in a benevolent fashion.
I think that benevolence was two-edged. And part of, I think, what lies at the very heart of what I call the Dallas Way, and which embraces sometimes very uncomfortably both the best of Dallas and the worst of Dallas, is the fact that acceptance of the way was long backed by physical force and violence.
Yeah,
there was the iron fist sat in the velvet glove and was prepared to move when needed.
When you say the Dallas Way, essentially, and there are sort of 5 points to it, but it's the way that things have been done here. This is our way of doing things.
Right. Mm-hmm. I only hesitate in terms of the use of the word our, but yes.
Okay, but as a city, I should say. So tell us what sort of plays into that.
Okay, it's a complicated phenomenon, and it's based in part on my notions of myth that the Dallas Way comes into being really before the second creation myth is established, the myth of Dallas being exceptional and almost accidental and just the creation of others. The Dallas begins what I consider to be a particular path or mode of city building or urban development in a way that, as we mentioned earlier, it's quick to use public resources for private ends. It's quick to engage in certain kinds of activities like the paying off of the railroads to have them locate in Dallas. A similar phenomenon took place with the coming of the Federal Reserve Bank for its region to Dallas early in the 20th century. I think it's important to understand that some of the most essential aspects of Dallas's way of doing things and a kind of ideology and structure of power actually were on their way to being in place before the events of the 20s and 30s, with the establishment of the Citizens Council, and most importantly, with the beginning of the effort to create a belief that Dallas really was the act of a small number of white entrepreneurial men who themselves knew what was best.
You say that we are a city in denial. Can you talk about the realities that we don't look at or talk about?
There are a lot of them. One of them is the use of force throughout Dallas's history. One could start at the very beginning, but some of the signposts that are important to note are lynchings that went into the early 20th century.
Of women as well as men?
Yeah, but primarily of black men. The use of physical force to break strong unions. And the abolition in both those cases, the erasure of the fact that there were these kind of activities as parts of Dallas's history. There are other ways a narrative of Dallas could be told that would admit problems of development, clashes, different kinds of conflict. It would tell the story in a more complicated way and not deny these aspects of the past. The denial, I think, when it comes to the 1960s and the trauma of the Kennedy assassination, which I don't think Dallas has recovered from as yet, is that Dallas doesn't have a sense that it has a complicated, messy past. It is like other places. Dallas has sensed that somehow it is different, really removes some of the psychological wherewithal and the kinds of cultural cushions did I think a big city with big ambitions needs to be successful and needs to be a more or less cohesive, coherent place. Dallas's effort to deny a history of conflict, I think, almost guarantees a difficulty in continuing with the conflicts one really should expect to occur in a big city with complicated problems.
You write in the book about Dallas's geographical location. We are sort of at the bottom of the plains. We're not really the Southwest. We're certainly not the Deep South. We're not Southeast. But we don't really associate with the Midwest. Do you think that our geographical position makes it easier for us or more likely for us to deny that we are like these other places with complicated histories?
I'm going to give you one of my favorite kinds of answers. Yes and no. Okay, by yes and no, what I have in mind is I think that Dallas has claimed itself to be part of all those different regions is as important as a lack of a sense that it belongs to one part of the country and one set of other urban places, rather than a lack of geographic definition by itself. Now, this is an issue that I thought about long and hard for the 23 years I lived in Dallas, and I thought about even much harder when I left Dallas in the late 90s to move to San Antonio, a very, very different kind of city, and then when I moved again, a surprise to me, to Columbus, Ohio, 4 years ago, I sort of looked at Dallas from south of it and now from north of it and east of it. What I'm convinced, and this has not been a popular idea with people I've spoken to in Dallas, is that Dallas really is a southern Midwestern city. The major migration routes across the country, aside from slaves and ex-slaves, have sort of marched through the lower north and upper south. When Dallas begins to look for models and imitations in its city building processes, it turns quickly to places like St. Louis and Chicago, other Midwestern cities. Dallas's tradition of city planners like Harlan Bartholomew and George Kessler come right out of the Midwest. It's not a very sexy image to be southern Midwest, but it might help a little bit more than claiming that Dallas is west when it's not, and southwest when it's probably not, and southern when it's definitely not.
Why do you think people bristle so much at the idea of lumping Dallas in with the southern Midwest? Is it just Texas hubris that somehow we're not like that?
Texas hubris probably plays a role, but I lived in Texas long enough to know that there are multiple Texas hubrises, the hubris of Houston or El Paso or West Texas or San Antonio, are different than the Dallas's hubris. So far, for what it's worth, the Dallas myth is playing much stronger in San Antonio than it is in Dallas. I guess the other Texas cities will chime in and say, oh, this guy doesn't like Dallas. He's finding fault with it. That's great for us. That's not the purpose of the book. But I really think, to take this more seriously and bring it back to the point that you raise, I really think the fact that Dallas has, as a collective place, never been really willing to pin itself on one kind of identity or one kind of definition. On your website, which I glanced at the other day in preparation for talking to you, Chris, I saw that the show had been cast in terms of what defines a city like Dallas. I would shift that question a little bit to say, who defines?
We'll talk some more about that after the break. My guest is Harvey J. Graff. His new book is called The Dallas Myth, The Making and Unmaking of an American City. You can call and join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Harvey J. Graff. He spent years as a professor at the University of Texas at Dallas. Now he's professor of English and history at Ohio State University. His new book is called The Dallas Myth, The Making and Unmaking of an American City. If you want to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So as to this question, Harvey, of who defines Dallas, you have a great quote in the book from A.C. Green, and this is about art specifically, but what it boils down to is this, and I think you might extrapolate this to other things. Dallas believes what others say about Dallas, but not what it says about itself. Do you agree with that? You must.
Yeah, I think in that and in many other things that A.C. was right on. Many of the things we've touched on and many of the topics of the book point to, I think, the failings of the myth that came to dominate Dallas. And that's the sense that the identity of Dallas, whether we take it linguistically or symbolically, or whether we look for a visual symbol of Dallas, whether it's a red horse whose neon lighting sometimes works and sometimes doesn't, or the Cowboys, or the TV show, the processes of Dallas's development, and here I think social development, city development, cultural identity, are all of a piece among the dominant groups in Dallas, and none of them singly or together seem to give Dallas a kind of center or an identity. It's, you had mentioned yourself in your first comment today, the humorous way we tend to say, well, Dallas is defined more or less by an assassination, a football team, and a TV series. To my surprise, when I began collecting material for the book, as long ago as 25 years ago, you look over and over, mayors, civic leaders, others regularly point to an assassination, a football team, and a TV series as serving to identify Dallas. Regardless of what one thinks about any of those, and I think a lot can be said about all of them, they're really not the stuff on which identity and self-consciousness or ability to deal with the realities of growth and its strains and conflicts in our complicated world. It's a kind of sorry set of three things, but over and over and over again, they're pointed to. It's a terrible burden for anyone or any one thing to carry, and I think that sort of lies at the heart of the Dallas story. Questions about identity, particularly identity throughout the 20th century as Dallas is becoming more a multiracial, multicultural center. That's just not part of these elements of identity at all.
I wonder if you think any of our issues with identity have to do with the fact that there are and have been for so long in our history so many people who come to Dallas and take up residence after having lived in other places where perhaps the myth sounds more realistic than it does here. You know, we know that it's not just about the Cowboys here, and it's not certainly not about J.R. Ewing. but you know, if you've lived somewhere else and then you arrive in Dallas expecting to find that, maybe you sort of continue to cling to that myth.
I think that's an argument that's often made, and there's probably some truth in it, but I would say that's the point that we need to look seriously at other cities, particularly other Western and Southern cities did have substantial immigrant populations, and none of them seem to have the same degree of difficulty with this kind of issue as Dallas. I think California cities are probably as good a set as any. One of the issues here, I think, is that Dallas tends to think that it needs to be different by being like all the other big cities, rather than asking what it can do or what it has that is distinctive in itself.
Have we lost the ability to decide on our own self-image and project that out to the world? Is it too late now to reform the way we've been?
If I had a good answer for that, I could probably write another book that would sell much, much more.
Even in Dallas.
And make you and I much more money than this is going to make me. I'm going to give you two answers again. On the one hand, my historian's and urban person's heart yells at me loudly, yes, we can, yes, we can, yes, we can, there are ways to do this. And among those ways brings us back, maybe not surprisingly, to myth. One of the lessons that I learned doing this book, one of the things that living in Dallas taught me as a historian, was that when you're dealing with powerful myth, that the issue was almost never proving the myth right or wrong. I think one of the great unlearned lessons of the Dallas myth, singular or double myth, is the fact that we can have 500 historians prove either of them to be true or false, and it doesn't make a damn bit of business, a damn bit of difference. These are not issues we decide by assessing their accuracy. Myths are powerful because they touch aspects of people's lives, because they synthesize many things around us. They're not accepted because they've passed the test of historical truth. A more important question for Dallas, I think, is what are the elements of the dominant Dallas myth that have helped it gain acceptance or consensus among, certainly not all, but among many Dallasites? I think Dallas, it would be very interesting to see if we could come up with another myth, a third myth that explains Dallas within people's mind's eyes and their hearts in ways that begin to address problems that neither of the original myths would do.
So you're not saying that there's
no... That's my optimistic answer.
Go ahead, continue.
Well, my not-so-optimistic answer is informed in part by what I know about social and psychological theory and about the deep divisions within contemporary Dallas. I'm really not sure just after 170 years or thereabouts, or even if we say from the 1930s to the present, that it is possible to do the kind of excavation of the elements of a myth and engage together in the activities that might potentially bring people together into the acceptance of a new kind of civic identity that wouldn't necessarily be something of a myth.
Well, the thing that I wanted to clarify, because I think people will argue every city has myths, including those that clearly have an identity. You know, there are New York myths and there are L.A. myths and there are Chicago myths that may or may not be harmful to the city's, you know, genuine identity. So what you're saying is if there were to be another myth, it would have to be one that felt more more genuine.
Genuine, authentic. I would rather use words like civic, democratic, shared, consensual. But you raise another excellent point, and it bedevils the student of Dallas. Is Dallas different, or is it like other places? And here, you know, I'm tempted once again to say yes and no, but I'm not going to say it this time, because I agonized over that question for 25 years, and I decided that Dallas is different much more in degree than it is different in kind. Most major cities share some of the problems, including problems of identity and security and myth that Dallas has. I think Dallas's situation, for many, many reasons, makes it different in degree rather than different in kind from other cities. So, Other people who've looked closely at Dallas say it's just fundamentally different, that the oligarchy's dominance, that the control of blacks and browns by whites, that those kind of factors make it much more different. I'm willing to say those are extremes within a common plane rather than a whole separate notion of difference. But it's a tough line. It's a very blurry line that's often moving just when we want to try and pin it down between those kind of judgments.
Harvey J. Graff is my guest. His new book is called The Dallas Myth, The Making and Unmaking of an American City. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Lisa in Dallas. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Great topic for the show. I'm enjoying it a lot. I had a couple of questions for the author. Growing up in Fort Worth and living in Dallas for about 20 years, and listening to you talk about cultural identity, I'm wondering, when you moved to San Antonio and had lived in Dallas, that during your research and thinking about and your living within Texas, in talking about cultural identity, did you ever come up with and come across the people when you'd say you're, you know, it's a Southwest, Midwest type of feel, that there was a pride of we are really more Texans than trying to lump us in with some other state or feel? And then second of all, wondering if, well, go ahead and I'll take the answer off the air. I'm just wondering if you have ever experienced the pride of Texans, because within America, my first and foremost cultural identity, even if I do live in Dallas, is not a Dallasite or a native Fort Worthan, it's Texan.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Hey, that's a terrific question. In part, I need to say, very openly and honestly, I'm really not sure about the answer to that. I was a long-time Texan, but I was not Texas-born, and I moved to Texas in my mid-20s. Part of an answer would have to lie in the fact that I think there are different kinds of Texas identity in different parts of Texas. I think it's a very different sense to be of and from Fort Worth than of Dallas. In San Antonio, it certainly matters whether you're Mexican-American or not. It's a very different sense of Texas identity and can incorporate elements of pride in being a Texan, but it's very different than growing up in Highland Park in Dallas or comparable areas in San Antonio, for that matter. One of the things San Antonio taught me is that it's possible to have much more complicated ideas about and more complicated public displays of a city's history than we have in Dallas. I think Dallas could learn some things by looking at Fiesta and other things in San Antonio. I'm not by any means saying that they resolve San Antonio's problems or that everything is fine there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey, great topic. I lived in Dallas for a few years and then lived in Chicago for about 8, was back here for a couple of 3, and then was in Los Angeles for about 6. And I've been back maybe like 3 years, 3.5 years. And what I always felt about the cities, you know, that I lived in outside of Dallas, Chicago and Los Angeles, was that even though I don't know that I could place an identity culturally on them, I always felt like they were more secure as a city in terms of who they were collectively. I always felt like that they set their own tone and set their own pace in a lot of different ways. I never, ever felt that way about Dallas. I always felt like it was a city that was constantly searching and was in some ways looking at other cities in order to find some type of identity. And where I see that more than ever now that I'm back and I'm going to be here for a while is with the kind of upsurge in the bling in the uptown area and all the rest of that stuff. You know, it seems to have this sad, we want to be like Los Angeles kind of feel about it. And it makes me sad because there's a lot of things about other cities, if you're going to take an identity from them, that would be so much more beneficial in so many different ways. And it's, like I said, it's just, in my opinion, it's kind of sad that that is the direction that a good portion of at least the downtown part of the city seems to be going in terms of trying to find out what their identity is. And I'll just take the comments off the air.
Thanks for your call, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
Harvey, what do you think?
I think that's an excellent set of comments. I'd say my experience before living in Dallas, in Dallas and after, are much like Tim's experience. But I want to add a couple points. First, it's very, very tricky to talk about identities, and we don't want to quite assumed that Dallas has a single identity or a single personality. It's a composite. I think one needs to talk and think about identities, but we also have to be aware of the limits of both the definitions and our data, and also the limits of, we don't want to create new stereotypes or peddle old stereotypes in doing that. But you know, everybody does talk about these things, so we have to embrace them. What I particularly valued in Tim's last comment, and is another of the elements that I see as central to what I call the Dallas Way and Dallas's course of urban development that is somewhat different, at least in degree, from other places, is the extent to which Dallas imitates and mimics things in other places. It leads to, I think, a huge paradox or even contradiction that goes like this. Dallas is going to be different from every other city by borrowing things that every other city has, whether it's a Frank Gehry Museum or a concert hall designed by Anne Pei or a theater center designed by Norman Foster or a bridge designed by Calatrava. Dallas has to have it all. It leads to a kind of collection almost of museum pieces of the 20th century that don't fit together, and they're certainly not going to go into any particular structure we call the museum. Sure, every city imitates. That's part of the games of development. That's part of a capitalist marketplace. But again, I think there are degrees and there are differences. Uptown has bedeviled me, and I've only set foot there once about 4 years ago. Some of Dallas's districts, and my book talks about Dallas does districts in trying to be like other places, make sense in terms of Dallas's history. Oak Lawn does, Deep Ellum does, Fair Park does. I haven't a clue where Uptown comes, except every other city that has a downtown seems to have an uptown. The citizens of Dallas perhaps could start demanding that naming districts and developing other symbols has a certain measure of historical relevance or accuracy, a kind of verisimilitude.
Harvey, we need to take a break, so we'll get back to this point in just a minute. Harvey J. Graff is my guest. His book is called The Dallas Myth, The Making and Unmaking of an American City.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Harvey J. Graff. He's professor of English and history at Ohio State University. His new book is called The Dallas Myth, The Making and Unmaking of an American City. Now, before the break, Harvey, you were talking about the importance of new areas sort of reflecting the history that they encompass in their area. One really interesting example from the book is when you write about Reunion Tower and the Reunion Complex, which, of course, got its name from the utopian colony that most people around here have heard of. But it's ironic because the colony failed within 3 years, and yet we sort of memorialize it.
Yeah, I think it's ironic in several different ways, and we can speculate about what that means. Not only did the Reunion colony fail, but it was a group of Swiss and French socialists. I dare say that the city fathers who came together to form the Citizens Council in the 20s and 30s would not have been happy about honoring a group of socialists, whether they failed or not.
So
it's when one plays kind of historical accuracy with some of the symbols, the whole how we see the world has the potential to change.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hello. SMU is going to host the George W. Bush Presidential Library, and I think historians are going to judge his presidency as one of the worst in modern American times. I think that's going to reflect poorly on SMU and the city of Dallas for years and years to come. Could you comment on that?
Let me say briefly that I see no reason to disagree with you.
Do you think it's likely that the Bush Library will become the fourth leg? Right now we've got a sort of tripod. Will it become the fourth table leg?
I'm not sure what the other three legs are right now.
Well, if you look at the artificial sort of ways that we're identified outside by the, as you've mentioned, the television show and the assassination and the Dallas Cowboys.
Oh, my. To be honest, I'm having trouble trying to accommodate the Bush Library into that pantheon of other things. I guess I don't see it as having quite the same power to organize perception as the football team and the assassination and the TV series. I think it sort of plays different culturally.
1-800-933.
I guess there's a small historical point that I would add in terms of Bert's comment, and that's to ask about what particular relevance or relationship George W. Bush has to either Dallas or SMU. That would be where I, as an urban historian, would begin raising questions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is I think there's a key element of Dallas that's been not discussed, and that is the ability here for people to come from all over and do well, in other words, succeed. And I've lived in other cities, Washington, Philadelphia. There's a sense of ennui and whatnot. I don't have that here. It's a very different feel. And then one other comment. My daughter was in Japan, stayed there for a while, and the people in Japan have an iconic sense of Dallas as more of a Western city, a cowboy kind of a city. And I think that dynamic of the ability to come here and do really well, succeed, independent spirit, that sort of thing, has been missed.
Thanks very much for your call. What do you think, Harvey?
Let me comment on the cowboy city point first and then the success point. Since Dallas was never a cow town, and since the cattle drives went through Fort Worth and not Dallas, the sense that Jim's daughter saw in Japan is a reflection on the TV show and other kinds of symbolism that have very little to do with Dallas itself. Now, I've been happy so far today, I'm going to ruin it in this conversation, by casting an eye at the cover of the book, where there is a map of Texas with Dallas on it and a longhorn. It took me a while to accept that as a draft of the cover, but the way in which Dallas, when it has wanted to pretend to be a cow town, has done this, including creating herds of bronze bulls downtown to occupy certain pieces of ground, shows Dallas's openness to manipulating that kind of history. I guess I would take the Japanese identification of Dallas as a cowboy city as a lack of understanding of Dallas. Success is a harder point. If we look at statistical data, certainly success is not shared by all groups within Dallas. And I'm thinking initially of Black Dallas and Brown Dallas, but Dallas has always had substantial white working class as well, and the image of success I don't think is particularly fairly shared or equally shared among different groups in Dallas. The image of success is part of Dallas's projection and promotion of itself. But to go further with that, I think we would have to look at particular images on one hand and try and compare them to data on mobility, on average wealth, family income. Dallas is as susceptible as any other city in the country to problems of mortgage foreclosure now and the market for buying and selling homes. Dallas, although it has pretended at times to be exempt from the American economy and the world economy, has benefited and lost in terms of the world and American economy. And there too, my message and the book's message is, don't simply believe me that I'm right, but look critically and closely at all these indicators and symbols. Try and get a view that perhaps is supported by different kinds of data. But I think all of Dallas's images really demand a hard and fast look, both in terms of their own accuracy, but even more in terms of why they play and how they play the way they do.
As we talk about these images, and I appreciate your candor in discussing, you know, going around and around about putting a longhorn on the cover of the book, this has been an interesting conversation because we've had a lot of calls. A lot of people can relate to much of what you say, but it's all sort of in the hands of all those other people who don't, you know, try to get to a more robust and genuine image of what the city is and an understanding. Are we all ultimately complicit in this if we live here and exist here and don't actively try to change this?
Oh, good Lord. That's an extremely hard question that I'm a little reluctant to take it on, but let me say this. If we think of ourselves both individually and collectively as citizens of Dallas, of more than residents, whether that's the city proper or something we call Greater Dallas or the Dallas suburbs, then I guess I would argue, at least as a professor, that we all bear a certain degree of responsibility for that. We all, I think, have a role in trying to create a civic, respectful, but open and free domain to argue and to disagree. I'll make the small point in regard to that is that although not all readers will find the Dallas myth to be an open, constructive story about Dallas or set of stories, I wrote it to be a constructive book, to be lessons to learn from, with at least some bits of answers to look for trying to do other things elsewhere. Part of Dallas's history has been a refusal to accept any kind of criticism as being constructive rather than destructive. That's a hard one to change, but that's where I would put my labors, and that's where I'm sure a program that calls itself Think really sees its own targets.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Ray in Plano. Hello, Ray.
Yes, hi. I have a comment and perhaps a question as well, but let me put it in context. I'm a businessman who lived worldwide in half a dozen countries and operated in three dozen and seen a lot of large cities, both in the U.S. and elsewhere. And we are proud Texans at Dallasites for dozens of years now. And your guest is talking about the myth in more real life. People usually call it brand. And since my wife and I frequently host the guests of State Department that come to Dallas in our home to just tell them about the city, when they ask, how do you feel? What's Dallas like? We ended up boiling it down to Dallas is actually a can-do megapolis, both civic side and the business side of that heart. But it's also red in the genteel southern skin. And that's a great brand. Now, there is past every large city, but that past is good and bad stages, and in Dallas, too, as we all well know. But looking forward, what makes the city and what makes the brand and the mix? And I would also not completely agree with your guest's thesis that Dallas economic and similar statistics are pessimistic. Dallas will in 20 years be the third largest megapolis, DFW I'm talking. In the modern 21st century, there is no such thing as little Dallas, little Fort Worth. It's the megapolis that everybody is thinking about in the U.S. and elsewhere. So I'm just putting a much brighter and optimistic note, can do in a genteel southern skin.
Ray, thanks so much for your call. Harvey, I know it's probably a hard question to ask a historian, but what about the value of just looking ahead as opposed to looking at what came before?
Frankly, I don't think we can really look ahead without looking at what came before. I don't think we can divorce ourselves from the ongoing currents of our history and the kind of differences that makes for different people in different places at different times. To me, that would be more on the order of a crime than of a myth, to pretend that we can somehow stop everything to come before this moment and only look ahead. Our resources, our roads, our habits, all the things that we draw on, the models that we reject as well as the models that we accept, all come from our own past. I think we could do a much better job, including teaching about that past, but also in showing the ways in which it impinges on our present and our future. But I really don't think we can start again tomorrow as if yesterday and today never took place.
Is there any value in your mind to arguments made by people like Richard Florida, who say that rather than looking at cities as individual entities now, we really need to start in this globalized world to consider the regions where we live as sort of megalopolis regions? In other words, you take Dallas and San Antonio and Austin and Fort Worth and lump everything together.
Sure. There's a lot of value in doing that. And in fact, that's really not Florida's perspective, but one that did an urbanist at Tufts University, John Gottman, developed initially in the 1950s and 60s in terms of there being urban regions. What's more interesting, I think, in Florida's work is his sense of some cities can grow their creative class and that others can profit. But he never claims that there's going to be a general benefit for the working population in those places. And I have a small vignette to add to the kind of Florida issue, the Richard Florida issue, and that's my hometown. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a very different kind of place than Dallas, of course. And I happened to be in Pittsburgh on December 31st, 2003, because my father had just passed away. I had the TV on in my room that evening, and I learned something that was never widely publicized, and that's that Pittsburgh, as it was seen as a great can-do, high-tech city replacing steel, Pittsburgh went into receivership to the state of Pennsylvania on December 31st, 2003, because it was bankrupt from 20 years of tax write-offs to bring in high-tech corporations. One needs to be careful in the postmodern and creative class kinds of development. Dallas, I think, would not want to follow that kind of spirit or that kind of settlement.
Harvey J. Graff is professor of English and History at Ohio State University. The very interesting book is called The Dallas Myth, The Making and Unmaking of an American City. Harvey, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Chris, thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you and to your guests.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.